Whenever you get a piece of good news, well, they always say, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Don't question it when it's good news. I don't know. In the case of the statistics on abortion, they have been dropping. There's no two ways about it. The incidence of abortion has been dropping since about, well, the early 90s. It rose steadily through the 70s and the 80s, and then in the early 90s, it started to go down, and it continues to go down. And while that is good news, it's some of the best news you can have. We must ask why. What has caused the decline in the rate of abortion during the 1990s? It's hard to make the case that it had anything to do with legislation or action at the federal level. 2003 was the first major piece of legislation passed at the federal level that had anything to do by way of curtailing the practice of abortion. That was a ban on partial birth abortion, and that's still hung up. So what about the states? What kind of legislation passed in the states during the 1990s may have had the effect of reducing the rate of abortion here in America? We're going to answer that question here in the first 25 minutes of the second hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Michael New, a Harvard scholar, joins us. He's author of a new report for the Heritage Foundation titled Analyzing the Effects of State Legislation on the Incidence of Abortion During the 1990s. Dr. New, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
First, give us the data, the numbers. What are we looking at in terms of a decline?
All right, from the 46 states that reported data in both 1990 and 1999, number of abortions fell by about 17% or so. It was pretty consistent. Very few states did the abortion rate increase. In almost every state, it fell between 1990 and 1999.
So we're talking about a fall, an average of about a million, down to an average of about 850,000?
It was at its peak about 1.5 million, and has dipped to about probably around 800,000, 900,000.
Now, someone might say, just people finally, the impact of Roe v. Wade and the impact of 4,300 abortions a day will eventually wear people down. Mm-hmm. Or as the abortion generation or the survivor generation born since 1973 comes of age, they consider themselves survivors of abortion. Maybe they say, that's not for me. My parents' way is not for me. You say that there's probably a more tangible way of measuring this in the form of state legislation. What do we see there?
Correct. I mean, there's, I think, a variety of factors that have led to the decline in the abortion rate and the abortion ratio during the decade. One thing, for instance, is the economy. May say show that when the economy is doing better, abortions go down, and the economy did better in the late 90s than the early 90s. But I think what's even more important is that in the 1990s, you had many, many states passing pro-life legislation. There was a virtual explosion of pro-life legislation at the state level. Just for instance, in 1992, virtually no states were enforcing what are known as informed consent laws. By 2000, 27 states had these laws in the books. In 1992, no states had banned or restricted partial birth abortion. But by 2000, 12 states had bans in effect. Similarly, in 1992, only 20 states had parental involvement laws. By 2000, 32 states had these laws in effect. So you had many, many states passing pro-life legislation. And I think that has a lot to do with the reason why abortions went down in the 1990s.
The legislation tends to fall into three categories. One, the restriction of Medicare funds. Two, informed consent laws. Mm-hmm. And what's the other category of state legislation?
Well, there's two more. There's informed consent laws, there's parental involvement laws, there's Medicaid funding restrictions, and there's partial birth abortion bans.
Which one, can you tell, has been most effective in reducing the number of abortions?
Probably the most consistent impact I see is actually the Medicaid funding restrictions. States differ based on their policies as to which Medicaid will fund abortions for poor women. Some cases will do it for what are known as therapeutic abortions, which is just about any reason. In other states, it's only rape, incest, and life of the mother. And those states that tend to restrict funding to only cases of rape, life, and incest tend to be pretty effective. We see the largest declines when they restrict that Medicaid funding. And how that's pretty consistent across states.
How do they shake out after Medicaid restrictions on Medicaid funding for abortion? How did the other categories of legislation shake out in terms of their effectiveness?
Probably the informed consent law was probably second most effective. And I was actually very heartened by that because that's a relatively new policy innovation. States only started doing that in 1992, and a number of states with these kind of laws went from 0 to 27. And just in case your listeners aren't familiar, what informed consent laws do is they differ a little bit from state to state, but they have three things in common. They all present women with information about development of their unborn child. They also give women information about public and private sources of support so they decide to keep their baby. And they also let women know about the health risks involved with getting an abortion. So we've had more and more states pass these kind of laws, 0 in 1992, 27 by the end of the decade, and they've been pretty effective as well at lowering abortion rates and ratios at the state level.
What about parental consent, parental notification laws?
They're probably kind of third. They're a little bit tough to really gauge their impact since they only pertain to minors. And in my research, I looked at the total abortion rates and ratios for everyone. It's a little bit hard to really gauge their true effect. The results there are probably a little bit less statistically reliable, but it does appear they did reduce the numbers as well.
And something that's mentioned in your report that is often overlooked in other research on this issue is the effect of partial birth abortion bans. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
I mean, partial birth abortion bans are kind of tough to gauge, largely because they only pertain to a relatively small number of abortions that do occur. And many states only pass these things in the very late 90s, so they don't have that much data to work with. It does appear they're correlated with a decline in the abortion rate, but since they don't have that much data to work with, it's tough for me to really get good solid results there.
While we're on that subject, what are the weaknesses of other studies that have been done on the reason for the reduction of the number of abortions in the United States?
I mean, many studies just really aren't all that thorough. They only look at a very limited number of states or only a very limited number of years. I try to be a lot more thorough. I looked at just about every state for every year from 1985 to 2000. Many studies really basically ignore certain kinds of legislation. Most of the studies seem to focus on the parental involvement laws and Medicaid funding restrictions. I haven't come across any studies that really look at the partial birth abortion bans or the informed consent laws. So I think what I've done is a lot more thorough, a lot more detailed than what's been put out by a lot of other researchers.
Now, why the boom of pro-life legislation state to state starting in the 1990s?
Well, there have been a couple factors for that. First was the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision in 1992. Governor Bob Casey, good pro-life Democrat from Pennsylvania, signed a series of pro-life legislation in the mid-80s. It was challenged, worked its way through the courts. The Supreme Court ended up ruling on it, and many pro-lifers are disappointed they didn't use this as an opportunity to overturn Roe versus Wade. What the Casey decision did is it did give pro-lifers at the state level a little bit more freedom to pass laws that would protect the unborn. So, for instance, informed consent laws, which I talked about before, were basically unconstitutional prior to Casey, but after Casey they received constitutional protection. Waiting periods are similar. They were by and large unconstitutional before Casey, but after Casey they received constitutional protection. So that was the first thing. The fact the courts did open up things a bit did give pro-lifers some more ability to pass laws to protect the unborn. Second thing that happened was the fact that pro-life candidates started to do better in state legislative races. It's well known that in 1994, Republicans won majorities of the U.S. House and U.S. Senate. It's less well known they also made some impressive gains at the state level. They obtained control of the state legislature in 11 additional states in 1994. They went from controlling six state legislatures in 1992 to about 18 in 2000. And, I mean, again, there are some pro-life Democrats who do very good, very important work, not trying to marginalize anyone, but Republicans do tend to be better on this issue. And the fact they were winning more and more state legislatures in the 90s helped enact all these pro-life laws.
What about governorships? Does that seem to have any impact if pro-lifers tend to have a slightly higher population in the 1990s in state legislatures? Does who sits at the state house in this governor's mansion seem to make a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, you need governors. The legislatures are only part of the equation. You need governors to sort of sign these laws into effect. And you did see Republicans do well in gubernatorial races during the 90s as well. I think at one point Republicans had over 30 of the 50 governors were Republicans. I don't have exact figures on how many were pro-life, but the fact they were doing well in governor's races as well also had an impact.
I know that you cannot prognosticate, but could we say that it is possible that the passage of pro-life legislation state to state during the 1990s and the reasons for it might indicate a future success for pro-life legislation at the federal level?
It's hard to say. You're kind of dealing with a little bit of different factors at the federal level. For instance, one thing that's interesting is that in state legislatures, in most state legislatures, you can't filibuster. If you have majorities in the House, majorities in the Senate, you can pretty much pass whatever you want. But in the Senate, the U.S. Senate, that's not the case. You can get 41 senators to filibuster something and effectively block it. So the fact that you do have the filibuster ability in the U.S. Senate does doubtless hold up judges that will support pro-life laws and pro-life legislation. But the fact that Republicans have been doing well in House and Senate races, I think there are some possibilities in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. It just may take a little bit longer.
And I guess it comes back also to the question of who's sitting in the White House at that point, because there were many attempts during the 1990s to pass the ban on partial birth abortion, all of them vetoed, and none of them overturned.
Right.
We waited a Republican president.
Right. The fact that George Bush became president, I think, made it very easy to pass that partial birth abortion ban. They were always very close to overriding Clinton's veto. They had two-thirds of the votes to override the veto, and they would need about 67 senators. They kept on stalling out around 63, 64, 65. With Bush as president, we only need a majority to do that, and we did that pretty easily. So having President Bush in as president did at least help pass that law.
What about those who occupy the bench at the state level? I'm thinking about very recently here in Missouri, a woman's right to know, basically an informed consent law, was passed, but almost immediately enjoined by the court. And while it's passed, while it has a veto-proof majority, it is not yet a law, and the question is whether it ever will be. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, Judge, that's a very tough issue. Judges seem to be a persistent thorn in the side of the pro-life movement everywhere. If I had a solution to this problem, I would run to the nearest mountaintop and tell everybody I knew about it. The only thing I can say is, I mean, in some states, judges are appointed, and other states are elected. If they are elected, the Right to Life community should just, make it a point to do the best to elect sympathetic candidates to the bench. If they're appointed, they should put pressure on legislatures to appoint sympathetic judicial nominees. I wish I had a magic bullet to solve that issue, but unfortunately I don't.
I wonder about the chicken or egg question at this point, having to do with whether or not the passage of pro-life legislation at the states is more a symptom of Americans becoming more pro-life, or is it purely a function of who's getting elected? How do you sort that out?
That's a very tough question to sort out. I think that you have a couple things. I think that I think it's probably both. I'll kind of fudge the issue there. I think that the national campaign on partial birth abortion, I think, did help sway a lot of people to a more pro-life side. And I also think that candidates have been doing a good job getting themselves elected and promoting this issue well. So I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Can we expect a continuing decline in the abortion rate if we've watched it drop ever since 1992 or thereabouts by 17%? Can we expect it here in the new millennium to continue to drop?
I think that you're going to see it continue to drop. I think I can be pretty confident of that. I think one thing that's happened recently is ultrasounds are becoming more and more prevalent at crisis pregnancy centers. More and more people get a chance to see their baby, and I think that does convince a lot of women to give the baby up for adoption instead of having abortions. And I think you also see more and more states also passing pro-life laws. I only looked at data up to 1999, but I know in 2000, Texas, in 2000, 2001, Texas put a variety of protective laws in place. So I think you still see more and more states passing these kinds of laws, and I think the numbers are going to continue to drop as a result.
You mentioned before the economy.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sort out the effect of the economy on the number of abortions? That seems to be a rather indirect an indirect cause here.
I don't have an exact reason for that. I mean, I use sort of regression analysis where I can look at a variety of different factors. I can look at simultaneously the economy, demographic changes, and legislation. I just think that when the economy is doing bad, there's just sort of more financial strains on people, and women facing crisis pregnancies may just have less resources at their disposal, and they may at the margin be more inclined to have abortions. And if the economy is doing well, they can find support easier. I don't have a real great reason for that, but just it's a marginal factor, but it's a factor nonetheless.
In the exiting polls in the last presidential election, it was rather clear that while abortion was not the issue of the election, those for whom it was an issue, it was the issue. What do you expect abortion, what role do you expect it to play in the 2004 presidential election?
I think it's going to continue to be a big issue. I think that most people in the pro-life movement are happy with George W. Bush, happy that he signed the partial birth abortion ban into law, happy he's at least trying to get some pro-life people onto the federal bench. And I think that, again, pretty consistently among single-issue voters, pro-lifers outnumber pro-choicers by about 2-1. So I think it's continues is always going to be an advantage to pro-life candidates, and I think it's going to work to their advantage in the future.
Are there types of pro-life legislation that, because we've talked about basically four categories mm-hmm. here, Medicaid, restricted Medicaid funds, informed consent, partial birth abortion bans, parental involvement. Are there types of legislation yet to be introduced at the state level being contemplated that may further the decline of abortions in America?
See, there are a few things I didn't look at. I mean, there are some states that have had waiting periods, but not many states have really passed them. I didn't really include them in my analysis as a result. Those states that have passed them tend to be kind of smaller states that I really couldn't measure quite well. That's one issue. That's probably the there are sort of other things that aren't necessarily regulation of abortions as such. They've been tried in different states. I know actually in Missouri, I talked to someone who's working on trying to get more funding for crisis pregnancy centers. Apparently, I think Governor Holden took that out of a recent budget. But Sam Lee, who's a good lobbyist you have in Missouri, is working hard on that issue. So some other different ways of approaching this issue people are trying.
Finally, what effect do you expect the report from the Heritage Center for Data Analysis to have? I mean, this is a really very interesting analysis of what everyone is recognizing as the trend in the number of abortions. What effect do you expect this report to have?
I think that it's going to probably give those – I mean, a lot of people are at the state level working very hard to try to pass legislation. It's never easy, and I think it's just going to give them some renewed confidence, give them a morale boost, let them know that all their efforts are accomplishing something, and that folks at the state level should continue to work hard because their efforts can and often do have an important impact.
Dr. Michael New, thank you very much for being our guest, and thanks for the good work on this report.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Michael New is a Harvard scholar and author of a new report for the Heritage Foundation titled Analyzing the Effects of State Legislation in the Incidence of Abortion During the 1990s. You can read this report, by the way, on the web at heritage.org. That's the website for the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. And I do recommend that you do. I do recommend that you do. It's encouraging news. And that alone is enough reason to peruse this report by Michael New. But more than that, to be informed about what's working when it comes to pro-life legislation. You know, very often the bills that seem to have the most flash or give us the most satisfaction of conscience, like the partial birth abortion ban or something like that, while good and while we got to work for them, are not always the most effective thing at reducing the number of abortions. Sometimes it's the less flashy, like restricting Medicaid, Medicare funding. Doesn't play well, necessarily, doesn't sound quite interesting, but it does the trick, and that's the point. You can read the report at heritage.org, heritage.org. For the remainder of this hour, we change subjects to Christian higher education. Last week's Time magazine cover story on higher learning noted that the attendance rate at Christian institution of higher learning were up 27% since 1997, whereas on the average, all higher learning institutions, their attendance were only up 8%. That's a big difference. Why is Christian higher education booming, and is it necessarily a good thing when it comes to the Christian part of that education? Dr. Pat Ferry is our guest. He's president of Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Ferry, welcome to Issues Etc.
Nice to be with you again.
Well, having looked at the subject of Time magazine last week, it certainly sounds like good news to a university president, seeing attendance numbers up. How do you interpret it?
Well, I guess, you know, there's just many, many facets to this. And clearly in our experience here at Concordia and across the Concordia system, we have also experienced enrollment growth. You're right to indicate that that is something that that we monitor very, very carefully. There are lots of factors. I'm not going to dismiss what Time has suggested as unimportant, but I'd place it alongside other issues, demographic issues and financial aid issues and just any number of things that contribute to this. But it's not I think it's significant that that Christian colleges are experiencing enrollment growths like those that are described.
What is it that an institution of higher education that has a Christian emphasis, Christian origin and basis, mm-hmm. can offer the person who's simply seeking to go and get their degree and prepare for a career and a life?
One of the things I think that's very important, Jeff, I mean, it's part of what we emphasize, obviously, is that we can match up with any school in terms of credible, quality education that will equip people for various vocations and what have you. But in addition to that, we really are preparing for people, preparing people for more than just making a living. We are preparing them for life, and it's I think not insignificant that this particular generation of students is looking to Christian campuses for that, helping with that sense of direction.
Where can an institution of higher education with a Christian emphasis, where can it drop the ball when someone comes and says, I chose this university because I wanted a Christian education at the college level?
Uh-huh. That's a great question. You know, it's funny because examples from people where this particular institution may have dropped the ball, or at least in their perception. So, for instance, someone may complain about their financial aid package, or they may have some concern about a grade in a particular class, or something that didn't quite go their way. And the refrain that I hear sometimes is that, well, I thought this was a Christian college. And so the impression is that, well, because we're a Christian college, somehow those things are insignificant or they should be overlooked in a different way. I think what makes a Christian college like ours distinctly so is the fact that it's a place that gathers beneath the cross of Jesus Christ. And by that I mean that we're a redemptive community, we're a community where faith and learning are integrated. But this isn't a place where you can escape the world. It's not a place where you can avoid some of the temptations of the world and so on. And so I think where some Christian colleges may make an error is in presenting sort of an isolationist perspective.
Our guest is Dr. Pat Ferry, president of Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. We're talking about Christian higher education on the occasion of last week's Time Magazine story, Higher Learning. When we come back from this break, the conversation continues for the remainder of this hour, and then we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Now, you might have sent your kid off to college saying, okay, I'm just going to close my eyes and grit my teeth and hope for the best. Or maybe you said, look, let's take the sacrifice. We'll send our kid to one of those expensive private colleges with a Christian moniker. And you found out that your child was exposed to all the same things you feared when you sent them to the state university. When we come back, we'll have Dr. Pat Ferry respond to that. Stay with us.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is there anything wrong with preaching that urges unbelievers to make a decision for Christ? Is there anything wrong with preaching that tries to motivate good works in Christians through the preaching of God's commands? What about preaching that contains neither God's commands nor His promises? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is called God's No and God's Yes, The Proper Distinction Between Law and Gospel. This book will help you recognize the difference between good preaching and bad preaching. To find out more about God's No and God's Yes, visit our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or, to order the book, call Concordia Publishing House, weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The raunchy Super Bowl halftime show. You've likely been talking about it, but have you taken any action to call the CBS network to account? Stuart Shepard got some advice on how to get your voice heard most effectively.
30, still on his feet. 20, 10, 5, touchdown.
People tuned in for the football.
Come on and dance with me. Let me rock your body. But the salacious halftime show, punctuated by Justin Timberlake ripping away part of Janet Jackson's outfit and exposing her, left many outraged. CBS and the NFL officially apologized, but Don Wildman at the American Family Association is not impressed.
This was planned. This was not spontaneous.
FCC Chairman Michael Powell has called for an immediate investigation. Wildman says you should let the commission know you support that.
It's time for the FCC to fulfill its responsibility as far as indecent programming. We're suggesting that the FCC fine every CBS affiliate the max of $27,500.
Melissa Caldwell with the Parents Television Council says after you call the FCC, contact your members of Congress.
I think it's also appropriate to send letters to lawmakers on Capitol Hill because they're currently considering legislation that would increase fines and allow the FCC to revoke licenses for broadcasters like CBS that flagrantly violate broadcast decency laws.
You can email the FCC commissioners and your legislators through our website, citizenlink.org. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
FCC Chairman Michael Powell characterized the halftime show as classless, crass, and a deplorable stunt. Our experts said it's probably pointless to contact CBS directly, but they said calling your local affiliate and expressing your displeasure might help put pressure on the network. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Focus on the Family.
When God created man in his image, he did it male and female, you see. So they have a masculine heart or a masculine soul, right? And that soul has been wounded.
Author John Eldridge and Dr. James Dobson share God's heart for men. Hear how you can discover an abundant life next time on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God's No and God's Yes, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
One of the great tragedies of abortion is that it offers women so much less than they deserve, sometimes to the point of being criminal.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Two Connecticut doctors are on trial for referring an 11-year-old girl to an abortion clinic rather than reporting possible abuse to authorities. In this case, the girl was impregnated by a 75-year-old man. A recent study confirmed that it is common for abortion clinic personnel to perform abortions on young minors rather than notifying authorities of possible abuse. Yet another way the impact of abortion continues to hurt women and girls.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Pat Ferry is our guest. He's president of Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. We're talking about Christian higher education. Last week's Time magazine cover story had to do with Christian higher education, the fact that it's just growing. One of the things I've always wondered about, Dr. Ferry, and this comes, frankly, from my own experience, having been the product of parochial education from kindergarten through college, into the graduate level seminary and beyond, is, and I wasn't shocked because I was a product of the parochial system,
right?
Of a Christian parochial system. But when I got to a Christian university, life there, while there were rules to try and curtail kind of college activities,
sure,
many of these things took place anyway, and I was a, I'll admit, a willing participant in some of it, most of it, maybe even all of it. Do you find Christian parents who send their kids off to a Christian university shocked to find out that campus life can be, in many ways, the same as at the state university?
Well, Todd, you're right. I mean, it's yes, I think so. When in the medieval period, when schools were first began to be regarded as places that served in loco parentis, that, and that was really true for much of our history as well, that the college was the place that took the place of the parent. Parents felt pretty confident in trusting their children to schools with the idea that those colleges were going to look after their kids and they were going to expect certain forms of behavior and what have you. That's a challenge on every college campus, and it probably has been for a good long time. It's certainly true today as well. I think, though, that at schools like Concordia and other Christian schools in general, that there is an expectation that accompanies the student's life on campus, also on the university's part, that this is a Christian community, and we would expect that there would be respect for the student conduct code and so forth. Now, what maybe distinguishes that on a campus like ours is that the way in which that's framed, because I'm sure most state schools have codes of one sort or another, but the way they're enforced might be different, and the expectations might be different.
One of the things mentioned in the Time Magazine piece is they call it a faith pledge, something like a conduct pledge or something like that. Do you have something like that at Concordia University?
Nothing specific like that. I think we have a student conduct code, a handbook that governs and guides student behavior on campus. But nothing immediately of that sort that requires students, for example, to pledge that they won't drink or smoke or dance or things of that sort.
And is this the kind of thing that and the rules that go along with it, like no co-ed dorms, hours in which the opposite sex can be around there, is that really effective in curtailing kind of the typical misbehavior of college students?
You know, most of the violations to our student conduct code, this is just being real upfront with you, have to do with violations of our alcohol policy, for example. We have no alcohol is allowed on campus, and students, some of them will look for ways around that particular rule or requirement. But, you know, we have staff who seek to enforce those rules, and students are clearly familiar with what we're trying to accomplish. And it's a big challenge. You have 1,000 kids who live on this campus, and you have to have some sort of code of conduct that's going to not only be responsive to parents and to donors and to other constituents, but that will just simply make their life together possible.
Dr. Pat Ferry is our guest. We're talking about Christian higher education. The biggest sticking point might be the money, Dr. Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
It is not cheap to go to a Christian college.
No, you're right. And I mean, your questions so far, Todd, have really concentrated on issues relative to student conduct. And you know, and I know about human nature, and we talk about sin and we talk about grace, and that's very important in our context. But what really sets a school like ours apart is the fact that in our case there is Lutheran Christian distinction, and that's prevalent and evident in the curriculum and the instruction and in the work that we do here. You're talking about finances now, and if you were to place one sticker alongside of another, a private school like Concordia could create a fair bit of sticker shock, no doubt. But the reality is, when financial aid is factored in, if parents are interested in sending their children to a school like ours, when all is said and done, more often than not, it's affordable for most families. We strive to meet 100% of financial need for our students, and generally speaking, we have good success there. We certainly have students from all parts of the economic strata. I mean, that's very certainly true.
In our own church body, and I think this might also be the same trend in other Christian colleges affiliated with other church bodies or all by themselves independent, the origin of a lot of these schools was to prepare people for church work, to prepare preachers or teachers or some other ways of serving within the institution of the church. That is very quickly becoming, well, at least in numbers, secondary of a function there. What accounts for this?
I think a couple of things. You mentioned historical. I think, though, that you look at some of Walter's own statements, and he definitely had an appreciation for a broader educational experience, at least if not professional programs, certainly a broader liberal arts education and not merely a professional one. But in any case, the fact is our church worker numbers have been increasing, but as you point out, the percentage of students on our campus studying for church work has changed a lot over time. Some of this may have been initially motivated, new programs and the like, to help make the financial realities something that we could square. The fact is that some of these other programs have been very important in enabling us to be fiscally viable. That, however, I think is too superficial of an explanation by itself. And our own, I think, Lutheran distinction in understanding the whole concept of vocation would suggest that preparing Christians, Lutheran Christians, for various vocations is clearly something that we should be able to do meaningfully and in a significant way. So while there may have been an economic impetus in some cases, I don't see it in any way as contravening our mission or our purpose, as long as there remains that continued strong emphasis upon the preparation of church work students. And I would again reiterate, the overall number of church worker students across our system has increased fairly dramatically in recent years.
Has it required that a Christian university, yours or any other in general, broaden its outlook toward its student, more toward what we would call as Lutherans the doctrine of vocation, mm-hmm. the preparation of people for vocations in every walk of life, not just church work, and preparing them to fulfill that vocation in faith toward God and love toward the neighbor?
You've said it very well. I think that's exactly the theme that has to resonate across Lutheran campuses, and it's certainly something we seek to emphasize here on our own. That the doctrine of vocation is really the student's educational experience really ought to see that somewhere very clearly presented to them. That whatever it is that they're preparing for in terms of profession or academic degree, that they need to see that this is a part of that sense of vocation.
I was recently on the campus of a University of Wyoming, I believe, in Laramie. It is a state university. You can find on that campus, as by way of student groups, every kind of religious opportunity you want. You name it, it's right there. And you can also find on campus or near campus all kinds of, there's a whole row of churches.
Yes.
Of every denomination and every style and flavor there as well. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm a 18-year-old kid come here, I can still go to church. I can still have all the worship opportunities. Talk about the worship life of a Christian campus.
Well, and I appreciate the comparison. I once served as the campus pastor at the University of Wyoming before I came here to Mequon, and I think you're onto something that really is not insignificant. But I might say, first of all, how grateful I am for our campus ministries on those campuses, like St. Andrews in Laramie and others as well, where campus pastors are serving in the midst of those communities. But I think one of the realities that is very important for us to recognize today with the current generation of students with whom we interact, there is a very keen appreciation and sensitivity for things spiritual. There is a very strong sentiment towards spirituality. But that can find expression in a lot of different ways. And students at the college age are very curious. They're very interested. It's important for us on our campus that spiritual interest finds very clear focus, and that focus is reflected in worship life, as well as the classroom and other student experiences. But you mentioned worship, and for us, that's a part of our daily experience here through morning chapel worship to Sunday divine service. So there should be no lack of clarity on a campus like ours about the one who says of himself, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life."
So gathering around God's word in a chapel setting, obviously not to substitute for the congregation or Sunday morning.
No, no.
But gathering around God's word and the preaching of God's word on a daily basis is a feasible reality on a Christian campus?
Oh, it is our experience, and more than once. We have daily chapel where the whole community is invited. It's not compulsory, but the whole community is invited to attend. There are other worship offices available during the course of the day. So by all means, that's a very prevalent part of what students may experience on our campus.
We're talking with Dr. Pat Ferry about Christian higher education. If you had opportunity to see last week's Time magazine story, Higher Learning, you may have had your interest sparked as well. If you got a question or a comment on Christian higher education, the phone lines are open, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. One of the things that I found rather comforting, although I will admit I never really had opportunity to make use of it when I was on the Christian campus, and that is the presence of a chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
There was a permanent pastor assigned to the student body to kind of oversee the worship life there as well, but also to deal with students in a pastoral way. Talk a bit about that.
At Concordia here, I have several reports from vice presidents, but I also have a direct report from our campus pastor. He reports directly to the president of the institution. We have other pastors on campus who teach in various disciplines, but our campus pastor is entrusted with responsibility for helping me, but overseeing the spiritual life, the worship life, the of our campus community. He's available for pastoral counsel. He's available on a regular basis for daily chapel, and he also teaches a class so that he can get better acquainted with other students. But, well, I tell you, it really is a great blessing to have a good campus pastor available for our students.
One of the things, and your university has actually probably been one of the more helpful ones to us in this respect on this radio program, the use of your faculty. Dr. Jeff Walls is with us on a regular basis to talk about matters of political science. Dr. Gene Edward Veith, of course, is a regular and longtime guest here as well, although I understand he's making a move sometime soon here.
He is, yes.
And Dr. Angus Manouge as well. We're going to be up there. In fact, in a couple weeks, the 18th through the 19th.
We're looking forward to having you on campus.
Yeah, at his invitation. And they function as a resource, I will say advisedly, an academic resource to the rest of the body of Christ who don't get to go to class day in and day out with them.
Well, and you know, that's very important to hear you say it. It's an important part of our strategic sense. To be a resource for the church. We've had others, too, that you haven't mentioned who I know have served you, John Seleska and Richard Iyer. And any of a number, and there are probably others who could be of service to you. But clearly, Concordia is a college of the church. And I think that is, in a way, a distinction, too, from other denominational colleges. We don't see ourselves as merely a Christian school. But we are an institution of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, and we're here as a resource for the church.
What about academic respectability? One of the kids that is quoted in the Time magazine story seems rather blatant and honest when he says, I ask myself, why am I at a Christian school? No one's going to respect me academically, but I'm here not to get a job. I'm here to become a person. Is sending your kid to a Christian college going to necessarily mean abandoning the dream of having any kind of academic respectability or that degree meaning anything to anybody who matters?
Well, it surely shouldn't. I mean, as a parent myself, I wouldn't want my child to attend a college simply because it was Christian. I think of Luther when he's talking about the cobbler, and he says, you know, because a cobbler puts crosses on the shoe doesn't mean that cobbler's fulfilling his vocation. He has to do a good job of making shoes, and we have to do, I think, a good job of an excellent job of preparing students for a variety of ways of service in the church and in the world. We strive for excellence in all that we do, and that includes establishing a credible faculty with academic excellence and featured in everything that we do on our campus. So I would discourage any parent from attending a school merely because it called itself Christian and encourage them to attend one that they felt like was also providing a meaningful, poignant, excellent integration of faith and learning.
So if asked, and I will ask, What is it that is genuinely distinctive about a Christian higher education as opposed to simply going to one of the diploma mills or going to one of the state universities? What's distinctive about a Christian university, a Christian college?
Well, what ought to be distinctive is this, and I can't speak for every school that calls itself a Christian institution, obviously, but what ought to be distinctive about Concordia is this, that matters of faith, our Christian faith, are meaningfully, not forcibly, but meaningfully integrated into every discipline that is taught on our campus. You know, once upon a time, Todd, many schools were Christian schools, but the fact is that Christian faith has been so marginalized, even on some campuses that once held Christian perspective very important, that it's no longer in the conversation. It's not there in the marketplace of ideas. And I think that leaves an education really rather bereft of something that's very significant. So when we recruit faculty here, whatever their discipline, I ask them to tell me about how they're going to find ways in which, within their discipline, it makes sense to interweave Christian faith, and specifically Lutheran Christian faith, with whatever it is that they're teaching.
What is the biggest misconception about Christian higher education?
I think that the biggest is, and this is a very general statement, but that because you attend Christian school, that there's going to be some compromise of academic integrity because whatever it is you're studying is going to be approached with a Christian bias. The fact is that academics of all stripes approach their disciplines with a bias of one sort or another. It's important that we're honest and upfront about our Christian bias, but that doesn't compromise what's being learned. I think, in fact, enriches and enables us to discuss from various different perspectives.
Finally, how is a Lutheran higher education different or distinct from Christian higher education in general?
Well, it ought to be, I think, distinct in the same way that Lutheran theology is distinct from other theologies, from whether it's Reformed or Roman Catholic or what have you. And so the things that are the main themes of our Lutheran perspective, sin and grace, law and gospel, whatever the case may be, that those are manifest also in the experience of the student on our campus, so that Christian faith is not reduced to bland moralism or to works righteousness of one sort or another. But then, again, whatever you might find to be critical to Lutheran faith, sacramental emphasis, so on, those things all ought to be in very much in evidence also in the campus experience here as well.
So how do you see the future here of Christian education? The trend is, obviously, they're calling it a boom in Time magazine. Numbers rising radically as compared to higher education in general. Where do you see the future?
Well, placing religious and spiritual interests alongside some of the others that I mentioned, demographics, economics, and what have you, I think that the prognosis is still very good. But I would say that, again, given the fact that this particular generation of young people is a searching generation, that it's very important that we hold our banner up very high and that our families recognize the particular value of a Concordia-style education, where they're not only on a Christian campus, but one where the tenets that we hold very important are also very much in evidence in the experience that their young people have as well.
You know, there's another baby boom. It's the millennial generation. Mm-hmm. The first baby boom from 1946 to 1964, 78 million by conservative estimates babies born during that period of time. The millennial generation, those born after about 1976, if I'm not mistaken, another 78 million babies born. It is another baby boom.
It is.
That is a huge challenge for you guys trying to crank kids through college.
Well, it's a challenge and it's a great opportunity, because my experience with the millennials has been one that would resonate with what sociologists and other observers are saying. And this is a doer generation. This is a generation that wants to have an impact. It's a generation that wants to make a difference. And I think, and I've said it often, that what we need to be concerned about is transforming these future heroes, and they will be, I think, the next great generation, but helping to transform them from mere heroes into heroes of the faith. And that's our challenge and our opportunity, and we're really excited about it.
One of the things that I'm fond of, Dr. Ferry, is the little tagline that we've adopted lately for Issues, Etc., Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced that what the Christian in general needs is, when he goes out into the world living in his vocation, is the ability to think critically about everything
yep.
in their life.
Yes, sir.
What does Christian education, how can it uniquely equip people to think rightly, not only believe rightly, but think rightly?
Well, I think our Christian faith emancipates us to be able to freely inquire and to study, because we have an anchor. We have moorings, and that will enable us to make judgments about conflicting perspectives without the sense or the fear that somehow our own faith is on walking on eggshells, as it were. That to me is a very important thing, that there is a ground, and we can begin there.
Dr. Pat Ferry, thank you very much for being our guest.
It's been my pleasure, Todd. Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Pat Ferry is president of Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. And by the way, folks, we will be broadcasting live from Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, Wednesday the 18th and Thursday the 19th of February. That's just a couple weeks here, less time than ever. And we will have opportunity to make use of some of Dr. Ferry's faculty there as we broadcast from Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. You know that the university was a Christian invention? Christians invented it. The college, the university. They said, theology is the queen of the sciences. And as long as theology rightly rules all of the sciences are open to inquiry by every Christian of goodwill. And so they gave birth to the college and the university. The liberal arts education, saying that a Christian needs, not only can know, but needs to know these things of the world around them. All of the sciences as they are found. Music and history, theology, of course, as the queen. Rhetoric and logic and all of these things. The Christian needs this. The command is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. While a big segment of the Christian world trends toward anti-intellectualism, we would do well to foster good, solid Christian education. Not only so that we might bring out of the other end of that educational system thinking Christians, but Christians who are well-rounded people, who know the world around them. We're called into this world, not to isolate ourselves from it, not to be of the world, but in it, to use the mind that God has given us, to know the world around us, the ideas around us. That's why Christians first invented the thing, because they understood that to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind meant that the mind needed to be nourished with knowledge and with truth. When we come back, third hour of Issues, Etc., open lines for your questions and your comments. We're talking a bit about Bishop Burke and black churches and politics.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.